And we are running. Okay, good evening one and all. When I did exactly this on Monday, I turned the recorder off. So nothing of Monday's lecture is on the website as a consequence. But hey, that's the way the cookie crumbles, as they say. Labs are meeting this week. I assume at least one, perhaps two, have already met. Any lab-related questions or activities or business? No, everybody's comfortable with the class. Everybody's at least now got to the Gaucho Space site and found the content. Okay, you guys are good. I don't need to babysit anybody. Okay, the lecture material for the class is pretty much going to follow the structure of the book, funnily enough, since I wrote it. So today we're going to do chapter one. We're going to then wander through the material on cartography in two lectures. But there won't always be a 2-to-1 match lectures to book. It's a reasonably good match week to week, but we get interrupted by Thanksgiving and so on. Towards the end of the quarter, I'll skip a couple of chapters or I'll condense them because I want to add a little bit of new material, suit the interest level up a little bit. I know what I was going to do. Just before I get started, just in the interest of sort of self-publicizing or whatever, go away, Bill Gates. If you go to a site, www.idmapthat.com, laugh if you will. But this is a sort of fun experiment that's going on in geography right now. We've set up these three sites, which are actually map-related sites. And the idea here is to gain information about where and why people put self-reported content onto websites, kind of like when you upload your photographs to Flickr or post your videos to YouTube. So we've set up these three test sites. One of them is called Map Your Memories. I'll show you that one in a second. One's called Map Bike Issues. So if you're a biker and you've got some gripes or whatever, that's a good place to go. And one is called Map Wireless Access. So we're trying to use that to get a student-reported wireless coverage map of campus. So you can report your locations there. They all look pretty much the same once you go in. If I click to begin, it goes to ArcGIS server, downloads a map, or uploads a map. If it ever refreshes. And you can scroll around on this, or you can when it loads. Man, this thing's slow. You can zoom with this little tool here. And, let's find a location on this. So in various locations on the campus, you'll find where people have... It must be Internet Explorer. It's so incompatible. If you you'll find places where students have already posted stuff that they've wanted to put. This is called Map Your Memories. People have posted things like, this is where I took my last final exam. Nice spot on the beach, that sort of thing. It's very easy. You just simply, once you get to a location, you click and it pops up a window. Seems to not want to do it right now, but it pops up a window that allows you to enter some text to associate with that place. So I say this because the more data we collect, the more fun it is. So you can enjoy those, I hope. Okay, meanwhile, back to the story here. So as I said, we've got these series of lectures. I'm going to get started right up with the first one. You're in a sequence of classes here, and you will be sort of like the diminishing crowd. I looked at the registration today for the class. It's about 100. I predict that we'll, in 176B, we'll lose a few, and then in 176C, we'll lose a few even more. But the people that finish A, B, and C generally are in prime demand. I'm already getting inquiries wanting to hire you guys, and you haven't even learned it yet, right? So the options look pretty good. This is 176A, Introduction to Geographic Information Systems, which I teach. 176B is offered winter quarter. It'll be taught by Mike Goodchild, and this is the last time he'll teach it before he retires, as I said. 176C is GIS design and applications. That's the class where you do projects and submit the projects. My MSO for geography was just over at the Emergency Management Center today for a meeting, and the 176C emergency management posters are still up there being used and shown. Again, I won't be teaching that, but it looks like Christoph Janowitz, our new faculty member, may be teaching that. So if you take the sequence, I would argue you've got about as good a sequence of classes and as good an education in GIS as you can get pretty much anywhere in the country. So take advantage of it. What are you going to learn in the lectures? I'm going to try and give you an overview in this class. This is the large class, so a big audience. And the philosophy I use here is that that many of you will end up in a position where you will become either GIS users or perhaps even GIS implementers or managers, in which case you need to be an educated consumer because there's an awful lot of junk out there and you can waste time very easily with this technology. So what I'd like to do is to sort of turn you into critical thinking, well-equipped, trained, and prepared to step in and use this tool for everybody's benefit. You're going to learn how GIS data are going to be captured, stored, retrieved, analyzed, and displayed. That pretty much goes along with my definition of GIS. Captured, we need to get data and put it into the system. We need to store it. That means usually storing it efficiently because these are huge data sets. We need to be able to retrieve data that has been stored, and these days that means finding data across an extended open network and finding the data that you want, and then getting it. Analysis, we are going to cover analysis in an enormous amount of depth in this class, but there'll be more depth in the second class. And then display, as I said, we're going to make some cool maps in this class. One of the important lessons I want to put across is where to go for information. I call this self-help. So you should never, when you're stuck, you should never sit there, you know, sort of scratching your head. There should always be a sequence of operations that you go through that can get you out of the jam. It's very easy, given the internet today, if you can become competent at doing this, you're going to be a long way because then you'll be a self-starter with the technology. So we will cover software and how it works, but that's the practical end. It involves some hands-on in the labs, but it also involves understanding some important theory and concepts. That's what I'm going to be covering in many of the lectures. I hope to give you a little glimpse of the future. Last July, I was in England to give a conference keynote on the future of GIS and geocomputing. So I've got some new ideas that I can share with you. I'll do that towards the end of the quarter. We're going to go over how to use a basic GIS, and I'll extend that to say that I would imagine that after this class, you'll be able to go out and find any open source GIS like MapWindow or QGIS, download it, install it yourself, and start using it pretty much within a few minutes. That's a challenge. And then GIS problem solving, this becomes more of a focus the further we go in the class sequence. And it's the main focus of the third class in the sequence, is how do you use this knowledge and technology to solve actual problems. Okay, so you're going to do it in a variety of different ways. You're going to listen by learning. Okay, and here I am spying in on the webcam in the Star Lab. It's an old log picture. It's none of you, and it's deliberately fuzzy. But here, you know, there's the TA at the front of the class waving. So they're delivering material. So not everything that you're going to find is going to be there on the computer screen or on the World Wide Web or in Wikipedia. A lot of what I say and what TAs say is going to help you. So listening, what you're doing now, is a very important component of this class. Self-learning, you know, the resources on the web are essentially infinite as far as GIS is concerned. I don't have to teach you that. You grew up with that now, so you know. But navigating it and finding your way around and finding some of the key sites where information gets posted and where resources are, that I'm going to cover in class, so we will cover that. And then, of course, we can learn by doing. Boy, those look like antiques already, and that's only a couple of years old. So working way through the labs is obviously very important, but, you're going to learn by doing these. Try not to, again, waste your time. Use the lab time effectively. Okay? So let's get started. chapter 1, contents. This is what I'm going to go over today in the next hour and 4 minutes. We're going to go over getting started. We're going to go over the definitions of what GIS is and why there are different definitions. I'll cover at least five principal definitions of GIS. I want to give you a brief history of GIS. Those of you that have taken my other classes know that I'm a big advocate of using the history, the development of something, to show why things are the way they are. So I'm going to talk about the history of GIS. It's a relatively brief history if you introduce a computer, but an important history nevertheless. And then we'll start this self-help thing. I want to cover some of the principal sources of information about GIS, where you can go to fill in whatever gaps might be left at the end of this quarter. Okay, so let's start with definitions. What is it? Ron Abler, very strong advocate of GIS, as he described himself, a pusher, not a user of GIS. This quote was from a very early document in the literature. It's simultaneously the telescope, the microscope, the computer, the Xerox machine of regional analysis and synthesis of spatial data. Now, if I had to sort of analyze that, what is he saying? Well, first of all, it's not one thing, it's a lot of things. It does a lot of functions. It involves being a sensor, what today we would call a sensor system. It's capable of gathering in data from lots of different types of inputs and channeling them into the system. That's the idea of the telescope and the microscope. The telescope, we can zoom right into something very specific and look at it in detail. The opposite. Telescope, we can go to something far off and look at it holistically. The microscope, we can zoom into something in specific detail and look at it in immense depth. And that ability to zoom in and out and change scales of analysis is very much what GIS is all about. GIS has a role as an integrator. So you might, or it has been argued quite extensively, that where things happen, as I say, everything happens somewhere, the location of an event is the most single or the simplest way to integrate the content, the information about events. So knowing where things are and where they took place and when they took place, the time and the space are very important. They're descriptors in multiple dimensions of what happens and where it happens. So it's an integration that can pull information together. It's also an engine. So it's a powerful engine that's going to be able to, you know, soak all this stuff up and integrate it across different platforms, across different layers, across different themes. And as I'll say over and over again in the course of this class, the GIS integration function is a critical one. It's important. Initial integration function is taking data that are non-spatial, more about this in a minute, and making it spatial, putting it on the map, and then allowing us to use all these powerful geographic techniques to analyze it. And then display and dissemination, that's the idea of the Xerox machine part. You know, the Xerox machine is capable of making graphics, so it displays content, just like we can make maps and images and put them out in different levels of detail and content and style. So we can produce displays, but we can publish them as well. So back in the early days, let's use analog maps in the history of cartography. There was an era when you would have to make a unique individual map that you would probably handcraft. You would then take it and put it in the lithographic press. You'd make production copies of it and you'd sell them. That was your distribution system. It might take months or even years to go through that cycle. Now it all happens like that because we can simply press a button now and publish our maps on the internet, so they're available within seconds of our having created them. So a very powerful capability. Okay, I often talk about this idea of geographical primitives. We are going to meet each one of these elements in you know, excruciating detail, but it helps to look at this as a generality. So I always say geography is a complex function with multiple variables. G is geography in this equation. It's some kind of function that depends upon a number of variables. X and Y are easting and northing, or geographic location on the Earth's surface, latitude and longitude. We're going to meet many alternatives to that. We're going to look at different coordinate systems that allow us to determine places on the Earth's surface. Z is elevation, so that tells us how high we are above the landscape. But it could also be building height. It could also be the three-dimensional form of the landscape, the height of the vegetation, the land cover at the surface. T is time, because things have different characteristics in terms of appearing on the Earth's surface. Some things appear as events, they just plain happen, and that's it. The time is the only real descriptor on the activity. A meeting of two people, a car accident. Some things have duration, so a building gets put up. It's there for 100 years and then it gets torn down. There we have a duration of 100 years associated with the event being the building's construction, the building's destruction, and the fact that it exists for a period of 100 years. And then the F stands for feature. So we, in cartography, we have a long tradition of taking the actual world and describing it in terms of features. I'm going to talk about this in more depth in just a minute. The feature model allows us to disaggregate the complexity that is the real world into simple objects, and then to describe those as geometric objects which we can put into databases. So a house, you know, it's your home, it's emotionally invested, it has a roof and a door and so on, but it can become a square black rectangle on a map, and once the location of that rectangle is in the database, we can do all sorts of things, interesting things about where homes are located, how far people commute, how accessible at your house is, and so on. Okay, so F stands for feature, and the kinds of features that get placed in geographic databases are pretty much anything you can imagine. Information about the hydrology, about the road systems, about demographic variables like population and employment, about societal variables like disease and mental health, actual characteristics of the landscape like land use and land cover, or tarmac, or impermeable surfaces, and so on. All of those things are simply features of the landscape. So this is what I mean by a geographic primitive, and you can already begin to see that this is a function that involves numbers. Next important difference here is objects and symbols. Okay, in the real world, we're dealing with real things, real objects on the landscape. But from the point of view of putting them on a map, those objects are often going to appear simply as symbols. So this symbolization characteristic is very important. There might actually be a mine shaft in this particular location in Nevada. Might have historical significance. But on the map, it's going to simply be a mine symbol. Okay? And if we don't know how to unencode the mine symbol, we don't know that it's a mine shaft. We don't know anything about it. Okay. So a bridge can have all sorts of connotations. We can think of a realistic representation of a bridge. That would actually be the way a bridge appeared in an air photo. We can think of a purely symbolic representation of the bridge, like a warning sign for the bridge, or a highly abstract representation of a bridge. That's actually a map symbol I pulled off of a European map at the bottom that simply says, there's a bridge here. Okay. If we can define an object of any type, and you know, it almost sort of becomes philosophy when you talk about objects, but an object can be a tree, a building, a bridge in this particular instance. We can think about that object as a generic object. So when I talk about a chair, I can mention that a chair may have legs, it could have two or four legs, probably not going to have five or two, and perhaps not one. Okay, so I can give it certain characteristics. I can begin to define and constrain my object even though I don't have a real object. And we do the same thing with geographic databases. I can set up a database that's going to hold information about rivers even though I don't have a particular river in mind. I know the general properties of a river or a road or buildings or whatever it might happen to be. So that's what I mean by an object. So a geographic object is the abstract representation of some feature. In the mapping sense, we've always dealt with these objects because on the map legend, and on the left-hand side is the roads and related features legend from a topographic map, somebody has sat down and thought about all the symbols that they need to put on the map that need to represent all the types of bridges that I'm ever going to encounter on maps of the United States. So it includes, you know, primary highways, secondary highways, light-duty roads, trails, underpasses, overpasses, a road under construction, a drawbridge, a tunnel, and so on. You need the full set of symbols for all of these things, but once you've got them, any particular one of those then becomes what's called an instance. So let me distinguish at this stage between a database that has been designed, it's got what it needs to be able to hold any bridge in the world, but it doesn't have any bridges in it, it's just a data structure, okay, versus a particular bridge that exists in the real world that's going to fill that empty structure with details. Okay, once I bring those details in and start to specify them, that's called an instance. So as soon as I have a particular bridge, like the Golden Gate Bridge, and I put it into the structure, now I have an instance of a geographic object. Okay? I'm going to deal with all those instances in the databases, but they share in common the fact that they've been placed into this common bucket, this object with its descriptors. This is quite an important distinction, and you'll begin to see it as we begin to work more with geodatabases. Okay, so let's stay with the Golden Gate Bridge and look at it in a little bit more detail. We can represent that bridge in at least two different ways, and they're both good cartography, okay, and they're both useful geographically. On the left-hand side, I've gone into the USGS's National Map Viewer. Actually, this is an old slide. We're two versions ahead of that right now. And I've got the road layer superimposed on a hill-shaded topographic representation of the digital elevation model. Okay, but the bridge itself now becomes purely a symbol. In fact, it's a red line with a traffic, road number symbol halfway across the bridge. Okay, it's purely abstract. It's a symbol in terms of a bridge. When I go over to, when I've just changed the background to the digital orthophoto image, a photo realistic rendering, a corrected rendering of the image from space, then I can see, oh yeah, look, it's a bridge. It's got a shadow. I can see the shadow of the bridge on the water. It's got boats going underneath it, and I can make those out. I can even sort of see vehicles on the bridge. Okay, that's a realistic rendering of the bridge versus a symbolic rendering of the bridge. We have both in GIS, and we can manage both. And in fact, the barrier between the two is beginning to disappear. If you use a tool like Google Earth, we can go into a symbolic map in Google Maps, drag my little man icon over to it, drop him down there, and all of a sudden I'm now looking around at the panorama that I would see on the landscape at that point. Okay, so this distinction between dumb or flat images of the landscape and intelligent vectors that actually, you know, make up networks and connections, this is beginning to merge together, largely courtesy of developments in GIS. Okay. Let's start in on some of the history stuff. Where did GIS come from? Complex story, and a lot more deep than you might think, and relatively few people have even begun to look at the history of GIS yet, but it's an interesting one. I argue that the background comes from some of the theory that's been worked out within geography, from the data collections and the necessary task of going automated with cartography. So the demands placed upon cartography by the computer, by automating the tasks. Computer science, where the database theory was developed and where some of the initial impetus was through things like the SAGE system, which I'll talk about in a second. And mathematics, because although much of what we do in GIS is rather simple from a mathematical point of view, it's no more complex than Pythagoras, let's say, some of it is pretty heavy. So once we get into topology and some of the aspects of combinatorials and complexity, it begins to draw more on mathematics. Okay? Today we're seeing an important fusion. We've got information systems technologies which are infinitely more accessible today than they were when GIS was getting started. You might say they're kind of ubiquitous today and they're part of the structure of society. And then we've got technologies which have sort of just caught up with us like you wouldn't believe. Among these are imaging technologies and positioning technologies. And if you doubt that they've caught up with us, I've got a camera inside this iPhone that's superior to any digital camera I owned up until a few years ago. It's really ideal. And it's got a GPS chip in here that allows me to position myself with a great deal of precision. Okay, so these technologies that were pretty remote, expensive, and inaccessible, now they're pretty much ubiquitous. And that's been a very important part of developing GIS and certainly mutating it in its current current evolutions. And then it's been argued, and I'll talk about this in a second, that GIS is actually a new interdisciplinary field, that it's come about as a cause of sort of disciplines clashing with each other and bits being torn off and merging in interesting and unusual ways. Whether or not GIS wants to be its own discipline, I don't know. There is a body of theory that's evolving. There are things like academic journals and conferences that normally define academic disciplines are beginning to appear. So you could argue that it's a discipline, although I believe that its home is probably within geography. Certainly you'll find GIS being taught everywhere from geology to archaeology to civil engineering, and that's great. Okay, I said I was going to give you definitions. I'll give you the definitions that I cover in the textbook. Anytime something evolves with different focus areas and different disciplines, you always end up with different names for things. So people in, say, imaging science would use different terms for exactly the same thing as people coming out of geography. And that's part of the problem. So getting GIS's terminology together took quite a while. But I think we're pretty much there right now, although there's still some disputes over what exactly certain things mean. All of the definitions that I'm going to cover right now recognize that spatial data are unique. As it's often been said, as Goodchild said in some of his lectures, spatial is special. You know, that adding the geography component really does add a significant component to data. And another thing might be to say that space matters, that knowing where something is gives an enormous amount of power to being able to map and analyze and display and represent where things are taking place. Okay, and then I think I said this last time, but I'll say it again. I'll probably say it at least once for every lecture. A GIS, at the very least, if we're going to strip it down and say what really defines it, it's the fact that it contains a database, information about stuff. That's the F, the features and their characteristics. Some kind of mapped information, which, as we'll see next couple of lectures, at the minimum means that we've got coordinates associated with things, and some kind of way of linking the two together, because without that link, we can't make one talk to the other. So, this is just a sort of simple example to show you exactly that. Here we've got three windows open simultaneously in some GIS. I don't even know what it is. I don't even know which GIS created this. But I do know it's British. So on the left-hand side, we've got a map, and here we've got a simple vector representation of streets, but we can see that parks are shown in green on this map. We've got, on the upper side on the right, we've got a query window. So we've got some kind of interface that allows us to go in and query the map or the table using a common user interface. And at the bottom here, we've got a table, much like a spreadsheet, with information that corresponds to the features that are actually on the landscape. Okay? In this case, we've got a database of parks, and we've asked for a simple query that says, show me the parks that are greater than a certain size, and those are being highlighted on the map in blue, and they're being highlighted in the table in blue. So my query is being answered both in a tabular sense and in a cartographic sense. I could count the number of parks that are greater than that certain size from the table. I can see where they are or calculate their area from the map. So it gives me a lot of flexibility. Okay, spatial and non-spatial data. Data are everywhere. You know, if you doubt that, you know, just try and register in gold for a class at UCSB. Open a bank account, you know, order anything on Amazon. You're meeting databases continuously. Some data just never really needs to be spatial. I've got a bike-related example here, but imagine that you own a bike store, and the only important thing as far as you're concerned is, what do I have in stock? You know, if somebody comes in and they've broken their handlebars, do I have the right pair of handlebars to be able to fix this bike? So the question is not really a spatial question. It doesn't really matter exactly where in the warehouse that pair of handlebars is, because it could matter, and it could be in Atlanta or something. But we'll assume here that all we need to do to manage information is to know about quantities feature descriptors, so what part am I looking at? Is it a wheel or a spoke or a handlebars or a tire? Now, perhaps I've got a part number that helps me in locating these parts so that I can find them or order them when I run out of the stock. Okay? There's nothing about this database that's spatial at all. I can quite happily use an information system to manage this kind of data. A perfect example of a really big database like this is, say, a bank's records that contain information about your checking account, who you wrote all your checks to, what your current balance is, when you opened the account, when you made payments, and so on. But none of that's particularly spatial. Wait a minute. Yes, it must be spatial. I remember whenever I travel and I charge something in South Africa or Chile or something, I often get a call the week following from my credit card company saying, "Yeah, what were you doing out there?" So they do know where you are through your bank account. So there must be something spatial about it. Let's move on to the green database here. Here's a simple table that is spatial. It's a crimes database, and it's not inherently spatial. I don't see any coordinates on this, but I do see an address. Okay, so this is where we have crimes that have taken place, and they've been located by a system that's not really a coordinate system. It's the address system. We have a very standardized address system in the United States. The house numbers on opposite sides of the street have odd and even numbers. They increment usually away from a central point, east and west. The numbers increase by 100 for every block. We only have a finite set of terms that we use to describe a street, you know, street, road, way, calle, whatever it might happen to be. But the number of terms that we use is really quite minimal. You know, compare this to a country like Japan, where your house is given a number in the order in which it was built on the street. So the numbers are just almost completely random. Okay, we can, even though this is not inherently spatial, we can make this spatial because GIS contains a capability called address matching. So we actually have a huge database of every street, every city, indeed every address on every street in the United States that we can use as a reference database to geocode these locations. That's exactly how Google Maps and everything works. When you type in a street address and you see your house exactly. We'll learn a lot more about that as we move on to chapter 5. Okay, let's finally get started with these definitions. Here's a couple of old ones. The oldies are the goldies, as I say. I still like Pete Burrows. He died recently. It's unfortunate to see that. But Pete wrote one of the more really nicely framed early books in GIS way back in 1986. And there he defined GIS as a powerful set of tools for storing, retrieving at will, transforming and displaying spatial data from the real world for a particular set of purposes. So there's those words again. Storing, retrieving, transforming, displaying. You're going to see these in several of the definitions. This has become called the toolbox definition of GIS. So literally a toolbox. I'll show you a toolbox in a second. And by 1995, when I wrote my first book on this, I'd simplified that to automated systems for the capture, storage, retrieval, analysis, and display of spatial data. People were a lot more familiar by then what spatial data actually meant. So let's take this toolbox analogy, because it's actually quite a good one. So what do we have when we open up a toolbox? There's a toolbox and a set of tools that might be associated with it. We have generalized tools versus specialized tools. Okay, so a hammer is a generalized tool. It can, you know, it can whack pretty much anything that we want to swing it at, right? And it'll do the task that it's assigned if it's whack that object. A specialized sized screwdriver or some kind of power tool that only works on a particular task, say a router or something like that, has a very specialist function. It's only going to work on one particular instance, one type of information perhaps, or one type of wood. Okay, so we've got this sliding scale of how general the tools are going to be. And as we open up ArcToolbox inside ArcGIS, you'll notice that there are some tools that you keep going back to, that you use over and over again. Those are the hammers and the screwdrivers of the GIS world, the things that we keep going back to because they get our basic tasks done. But then sometimes you'll need to get that nuanced tool out that's just going to do, say, downslope flow accumulation in a river network or something like that. Those are the specialist tools. Okay, we can talk about tools that cut and tools that join. And cutting tools are things like saws and axes. And joining tools are things like, specialist tools for making elaborate wooden joints or glue or screws, bolts. Okay, and there are pieces within GIS that are designed for taking maps apart, separating them by layers, clipping them to a certain area, disaggregating information, and there are tools that do joining operations. So if we've got multiple layers we want put together, if we've got disconnected polygons that we would like to attach, if we've got non-overlapping polygons that we would like to overlap and then add new intersections and lines, join stuff together and generate new information, we can also do that. Okay. We have complex tools and simple tools. You know, a hammer is pretty much a hammer. You know, it's almost indestructible. Although apparently the Air Force is willing to pay over $1,000 to make one indestructible. A regular one is not. Some tools are extremely complex. You know, they come with elaborate user manuals, bench saws, or elaborate power screwdrivers. Okay, the same thing for GIS. Some parts of our toolbox are so simple that you won't even think about it. You know, click, 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 it's done. The map's on the screen. Others are going to need a lot more input from you, perhaps even a little bit of fine-tuning or understanding what the parameters are or how the tolerances are selected that go along with making a particular type of map. And you have tools that are cheap and tools that are expensive. You can pay $6.99 for a hammer over at Osh that's probably going to be good for several years, or you could be the Air Force and pay $1,000 for a hammer. We can get the cheapo and the luxury version of every single tool that there is, and GIS is very much the same way. You know, we can go out for free and download QGIS, let's say, and get something done, something relatively simple done, pretty much immediately. But again, if we want something done in a professional environment with a particular set of constraints, we might need to go out and buy the Cadillac and do it correctly. Okay. I could go on extending this analogy forever, but it would take all evening. Generally speaking, I like this model, the one at the bottom. I've called it the MIMO, or the Map In, Map Out model. And it's very common. You're going to see this over and over again as you use the toolbox. What the tool does is it transforms the information. So we have input. We need stuff that we need to load before we can do our operation. Let's say we must have a vector layer and it must be active. Then we can do something to it, change the datum or the map projection, and as a result, it's going to produce some kind of output, a map in a new projection or a new coordinate system. Okay? So hold that model in mind because it works over and over again with GIS. Okay. The toolbox definition is good. It's my favorite, and you'll see why it's so practical. But it's not the only one. So let's go on here. GIS is also an information system. Information systems has a long tradition. It's kind of an interesting tradition because it has a heritage in computer science from a theoretical perspective, in business from a business management perspective. That's how IBM got founded, as the business machine management system. And it has an origin in library science because libraries are one of the great users of online information. So here's Jeff Starr and Jack Estes are both former members of faculty in this department, both now dead. It's the Starr Lab that you... God, these are definitions from dead people. I guess GIS is getting old, right? Jeff Starr and Jack Estes wrote this book in 1990 in which they defined geographic information system as an information system that's designed to work with data spatially referenced by spatial or geographic coordinates. So to them, you take an existing information system, you stick coordinates into it, and now somehow it's turning into a GIS. GIS is both a database system with specific capabilities for spatial reference data, as well as a set of operations for working with the data. That's an acknowledgement of the tools. Here they're termed operations. Okay? So this is the kind of definition that you sort of favor if you spend most of your time in the query window, doing selective operations on the database. So if you're more interested in organizing and reorganizing the information, finding particular records, and managing the data as a whole, this is the definition you tend to favor. And some people do this. You know, Oracle, the huge database company, the database management company, the largest, probably the largest in the US, has a product called Oracle Spatial, which is their standard suite of software with a whole bunch of geographic functions associated with it. That is very much an information system and comes out of the information system tradition. And again, here's my history kicking in. This is the way we used to manage geographic information. We would have a map library, and we actually still have a map library over there, and although we're about to move it because they're about to demolish that building and rebuild it. What do we have inside the information system? Well, we need storage. So in the paper map era, we had to have tons and tons of map trays in which to store all the individual maps. We needed some kind of organizational system, a filing system. We needed a query interface, and we had a human query interface where you simply tapped on the bell, waited for somebody to come, and you said, gee, I'd really like the 1948 Slovakian coverage of whatever, and they might be able to help you find it. They're usually very good at doing that. We still, even when we had analog data, we still had to use the same things that we used to organize geographic information systems in computers. Okay, we needed layers. Okay, here literally layers. We would sort the maps and put them in different drawers on top of each other. We needed themes. So these are cataloged by state, by country, by map series. Okay, so we've got continuous coverage. We've chopped it up geographically and put each map in a different drawer. So this is just a way of partitioning the database to make it manageable. And we do exactly the same thing when we manage GIS from GIS context. It's that community, the information systems community, that gave us one of the most commonly used models that we see over and over again in GIS, and that's this idea of map overlay. It's a particular approach. It was popularized early on in GIS, and it's a theme that stayed with the technology. So if you can imagine that we can separate the real world into layers, and each layer pertains to one variable, one attribute. So we might have a separate layer that is the soils map, that just contains information about soils. Another one that just has information about the forestry. Another one that just has information about the hydrology. What we get by adding them all together, being able to sort of squeeze them together into a single layer, is that we can do compound operations that are much more sophisticated than what we'd be able to do on a single layer just by itself. So the simplest way of doing this would be to do, a binary solution. So we'd say we want to find a location that has to be on a particular type of soil. It has to be not in a forest, and it has to be at least 100 meters from a lake. When we squeeze the layers together, you can imagine that just can be one set of solutions that are the places that meet those criteria. Very powerful, very simple model, and we're certainly going to be able to do this in GIS. Okay, this is using that information systems definition. This is a definition that goes back to 1979. It's sort of like ancient history now. Did they have computers then? I guess so. Ken Dyker, who was an urban planner, gave us this definition. GIS is a special case of information systems where the database consists of observations on spatially distributed features, activities, or events. I like that because we usually just think about features, but here we're also talking about activities like human movement, you know, the commute to work, migration, and so on. Or events, you know, meetings of individuals, happenings, presidential election discussions. These are all events, you know, World Series playoff games that have definable locations. And we can define these in space as points, lines, and areas. I would argue volumes as well, but we'll deal with that later. So a geographic information system manipulates data about these points, lines, and areas to retrieve data for ad hoc queries and analyses. Okay, that's really pretty cool because we've got the retrieval part in there. The ad hoc part means that we don't have to know in advance exactly what we want to be able to do. We've got the tools to be able to solve at a particular location for a particular problem. So this is overlaps a little bit with the toolbox definition. It does introduce this feature model because it talks about features, activities, or events. So I'll spend a minute here on the feature model. The standard feature model divides a mapped landscape up into features, and those can consist geometrically of points, lines, and areas. I always note that a map is not a map unless it's got some text on it somewhere, so we need to be able to read it. If you doubt that, just look at a map with no text on it. It's completely unintelligible, especially if you don't know where the area where it is. And then also, we often need to deal with volumes, or at least the upper surface of a volume, like the surface of the landscape. Using GIS involves capturing spatial distribution by measurement of the world or of maps, so that we can either make measurements from the real world, let's say take locations with a GPS receiver, or we can use the map to get locations. That works equally as well. Almost everything we do is spatially distributed, so we can study it in GIS. And it's the features that we're going to use to manage the data. So that's, I think, what Ken Dyker was pointing out here. So here's a simple example, a local one. You can imagine a single point. So Goleta Point is a location. You can imagine going out and standing there. You get rather wet. Not a good place to put your surfboard in, but it does actually exist. The benchmark, represented by a triangle and a height of 38 feet there on Campus Point. I've spent a good many hours looking for that and never found it. At some point, there must have been a marker there, a bronze marker, that actually defined that point and defined that location on the landscape. So that is actually a point. And there are points everywhere when you think about it. You know, wells, road intersections, business locations, addresses, anything that's point-like. And then there are lines. Roads, political boundaries, contour lines, pipelines, outlines of features, all of these form lines on the map, and we can represent them as lines. A point can be represented by one pair of coordinates, an x and y value, or an easting and northing, as we say in cartography. But a line, we need a sequence of points, and they have to be in the correct sequence. We can't just randomize the sequence of points of the coordinates and expect the line to draw correctly. And then we have areas. So here we have... That's actually, I believe, is part of Lake Kachuma. So we have a blue area that represents the water. We have a green patchy area that represents chaparral vegetation. And we could imagine drawing a line around the outside of those, and it would form a polygon, an irregular polygon, that would delimit the area in which we're interested in. Now, polygon's not that much different from a line. There are only two differences. One is that the line has to close back on itself, so eventually it has to have one point that's in common somewhere on the boundary, and we also need to talk about the inside of the polygon, not the outside of the polygon. So we need containment as a variable associated with the polygon. Points, lines, areas. We're going to deal with all three inside GIS. That's what we mean by a feature model. Continuing with Ken Dyker's definition, GIS is flexible enough to be used for ad hoc query and analysis, and that usually means that we've got spatial data and we're going to ask questions about places. So we're going to show me the locations of all the things that meet these criteria, or show me the names of all the cities in the world that begin with the letter A. Okay, completely arbitrary, but we can still do it using the GIS. And then furthermore, GIS can do analysis, so we can use it the same way we'd use, say, a statistical package to analyze data and do hypothesis tests. We can do modeling, so we can do, say, simulation of things, and we can do forecasting and what's often called prediction. So if we have a GIS that's correctly configured, we could run a model that, say, simulated land use change into the future, or simulated which areas were going to be subject to mining claims, or where a pollutant plume was going to move in the next 10 years. These are very important things to be able to do. All right. Well, going slowly tonight. Definition number three. And this one is one that's prominent throughout the book for this class and certainly for the one used next class. GIS is a way of doing science. It's an approach. It's a method. That means that GIS is more like astronomy than it is like the telescope. Okay, the toolbox definition would argue that GIS is the telescope. But this is arguing that it's also astronomy. Okay, so geographic information science, as it's been termed, and this conveniently has the same initials GIS, is both a research on and with GIS. So if we use the tool, we're doing GI science, and if we're doing research on the tool or on its capabilities or using it to open up new ideas, then we're doing GI science. This comes from a classic paper by Mike Goodchild, features 176B, in an article in the International Journal of Geographic Information Systems in 1992. After this article, the journal changed its name to the International Journal of Geographic Information Science, largely as a consequence of this paper. So he defined GIS as the generic issues that surround the use of GIS technology, what's often now called GIST, Geographic Information Systems and Technology, that impede its successful implementation. So that's things like errors and dealing with vague concepts and so on, or emerge from an understanding of its potential capabilities. So if using GIS allows you to do something you couldn't do before, you know, if Galileo sets up the telescope and now he can see Jupiter and can count the moons and use them to do navigation, now we've really got something going. Okay, so that's what this definition of GI science means. Most people like definition number four. GIS is an extraordinary multi-million-dollar business. By my last count, I don't look at numbers very much, but by my last count, the GIS industry was the same size as the frozen foods industry in the United States. Okay, that's quite a big one. If you just go and look at the frozen foods section in the supermarket, it's a pretty big deal. It's a lot of jobs. It's hundreds of thousands of jobs, both in the United States and elsewhere. And the weird thing is it's just continued to grow. There's this magic growth rate of between about 8 and 12% that's been the growth rate for activity in GIS, and that rate's been consistent now for almost 20 years. And it's still consistent, even though we have a nasty recession going on. So you're sitting in the right classroom right now if you're looking for a job in hard times. This is a quote out of my book. The growth of GIS has been a marketing phenomenon of amazing breadth and depth and will remain some for many years to come. It hasn't even finished percolating the market yet. There's a lot more to come. Clearly, GIS will integrate its way into our everyday life to such an extent that it will soon be impossible to imagine how we functioned before. And that's already happened. You know, who gets lost in their car anymore? Nobody, right? You just turn on the TomTom, you know. Who takes it for granted that you can order a book today on Amazon and it'll arrive at your front door tomorrow? You can't do that without GIS technology. Okay, lots of things that we take for granted are really done by GIS, and making it work and making it work better is indeed an enormous business. So all industries have spatial extent, right? We teach that in economic geography. If you want to deal with steel, you go to Pittsburgh, right? If you want to deal with cars, you go to Detroit. These are the big centers in the United States where GIS is an industry, and it looks very much like the information systems and technology, high-tech industries, generally speaking. So you can see the influence of the major cities, the Washington-Baltimore corridor. There's a huge center in Virginia around Washington, D.C. Boston shows up as a major center, Denver, some of those cities in Texas. Southern California, you're pretty much at ground zero as far as the GIS industry is concerned right here. And if you doubt that, just pull out a directory and start looking at the firms in this area. And you'll very quickly see firms that are doing work and some degree research, but in many cases production work around GIS and spatial technologies. And then, of course, Silicon Valley and the Bay Area and Seattle and many other places besides. It's a highly distributed industry. Increasingly, people can work in it and not be in it, be in a virtual space. Okay, I'm going too slowly, so let's try and speed up a little bit. Here's the definition that I added when I wrote the fifth edition of the textbook, and that is that GIS plays a it plays a role in society. That as soon as you implement GIS, it changes the way people and organizations function. And if you want an analogy, just think of the internet. You know, the internet has radically transformed a business. You know, I can remember, just travel. I always say time and space are interchangeable. Just travel. Go to Italy. I spent part of my sabbatical in Italy. When you buy anything in Italy, then you have to sit there while they handwrite out a receipt for what money you've given them, and they hand it to you in handwritten stuff. You buy anything in the U.S., scan your card, receipt prints, and you walk out with it. Or perhaps you don't even want it. It gets emailed to you or something like that. Big change in the way we do business as a consequence. A lot of this has come about because of GIS. Nick Chrisman, in his book, Exploring GIS, 1999, and he subsequently put out a second definition, spent a lot of time in the early chapters in that book talking about defining GIS as an activity. It's a sort of almost like a social activity. So he said it's an organized activity by which people measure and represent geographic phenomena and then transform these representations into other forms while interacting with social structures. In his particular context, he was largely thinking about planning and how geographic information could be used to change opinion. Subsequently, we've seen direct proof of this philosophy. I believe it was Bill Clinton in his first run for office was the first president to use GIS to organize political activities leading up to an election by looking at data, choosing where trips were going to be made, flights were going to be made, bus tours, we're going to take in locations that were going to maximize the vote turnout for a particular candidate. Now both sides use it, and it even gets used at the local level for politics. So that's social structures. This is his view. I transformed his diagram in his text, which I found a bit obscure, into a metaphor. He believed that at the outset, at the wide end of the funnel, we have social and cultural context. And that, that involves things like language, and meetings, and social structures, and how we interact. And it does have a huge amount of significance. The way GIS is implemented in, say, the United States in a high-tech company that realizes the value of a GIS versus the way it might be implemented in, let's say, a third world setting with insufficient capital and cultural and institutional structures in place that are just inviolable. These are two different sides of the coin. Within that, there's an institutional context. If there are no supporters, if there's no money, if there's no infrastructure, if you can't even get onto the internet, then it ain't going to happen, basically. But once it does happen, we take in data, we begin to transform it and perform operations on it, and that often involves representations, maps, and so on, and these are based on and produce measurements. So you might think, in his context, he's particularly thinking about cadastral mapping. So you think about the cadastral map, the basis of land property and ownership, originally largely obscure. You had to get a licensed surveyor to come out and survey your property if you wanted to sell your house. There might be a record of your property ownership, but it would be a map, literally a hand-drawn paper map that was the legal description of your property. Now we transform that and make an online database that contains the legal definition of your parcel, and I can use it to query, then I can create things like Zillow and so on. Okay, so there's my five definitions. I'll leave it at that point. You're quite welcome to add more definitions, but I don't think there will be a sixth edition because I don't know if it's in me. All right, so let's go on the history and give you some context and background. So the origins, I would argue, the most important origins for GIS, from my point of view, lie in thematic cartography. Thematic cartography is that part of cartography that deals with information about one phenomenon, not lots of phenomena. Many planners began to use the method of map overlay using manual techniques, and so that when we came to want to automate these things, the manual equivalents were already pretty well shaped and formed. And automating them was really just a mechanization. It didn't require any new theory or discovery. Manual map overlay as a method was first described meticulously, step by step, in 1950 in a planning textbook by Jacqueline Tirrett. So I'd argue that from a historical point of view, this methodical setting down of how you get map information together and combine it to solve a problem was already worked out well in advance of the computer being applied to the same problem. And this idea was taken up and popularized by Ian McHarg in an extraordinary book called Design with Nature, which was enormously influential for environmental planning. What did he do in that? He used transparent overlays, sheets of transparent Mylar paper that he traced off of maps and painted out the areas that were unsuitable for projects with ink, and then would hold them up to the light so that the area would shine through. That was his solution set. Here's Ian McHarg, just before he died. So, God, this is like dead people's lecture, isn't it? Just before he died, he came and I actually interviewed him for 2 hours here at UCSB. He gave a lecture here. and I had dinner with him. And he was really a remarkable guy. He had the thickest Scots accent you've ever heard in your life, and it's not by chance that he has a cigarette and a glass of whiskey in his hand. That was a typical instance. This is the book, Design with Nature, and if you've never come across it, it might be worth a glimpse, or online versions of the graphics and so on now. But highly influential. It really did take inventing this idea that you didn't have to simply plow the landscape down before you could build something, that you could actually design with nature. This transformed everything. But I would argue the precedent was already set by Jacqueline Turrett's book. This is an illustration from her book, in which she's... the book is about town and country planning. This is only one chapter in the book. And the idea is... It really comes out of World War II. When Britain emerged from World War II, whole swaths of London had just been knocked flat. In fact, the preparation for the Olympics next year in London, in parts of East London, is developing for the first time sites that were bombed by the Luftwaffe in the 1940s. So after the war, when they expected people to return, they obviously planned new development and restructuring. So she set about, in her book, simply saying, well, what's worth preserving? How can we do this with some degree of intelligence? Let's get maps of all the suitable soils. Let's look at the drainage pattern. Let's look at the road network and its capabilities. We obviously don't want to have to build too many roads all over the landscape. Let's look at archaeological sites or sites of value that need to be preserved, and let's try and put those in areas where we don't damage them. And let's look at the land use. And then putting all these layers together, and her book contains meticulous instructions for how to make the register marks, how to punch out little holes in the corners and put them over pins so that you could get the layers in perfect registration with each other to come up with the integrated solution map to the entire question. So again, I'd use the argument that the analysis had already been thought through before the computer came onto the scene and really allowed us to do it, you know, with great degree of efficiency. So the 60s, let's go through the history there. We saw all sorts of new forms of geographic data, an interest in automating the census, for example, of the United States. We saw computer cartography begin to develop in the 1950s and 60s. That was largely being driven by the military and their mapping needs of the Cold War. We began to see software modules being written sort of like standalone computer programs. So in the early days, they did an inventory of all the programs that did sort of geographically related tasks, and they typically just did one thing. You know, they took raw latitude and longitude points and converted them into a map projection, or they you know, looked for dangling nodes on a vector map. But then the whole idea of having a single user interface to put them all together began to emerge as recently as the late 70s and 1980s. Some very influential data sets were the World Data Bank, brought to you by the Central Intelligence Agency. Very early on in the mid-1960s, the CIA digitized the entire world outline at about 1 to 1 million scale and released that as a public domain data set. They then went back and did it again in more detail and released that. And those data sets are still used today. They're enormously valuable. And the census decided to go ahead with a project called a geographic base file based on dual independent map encoding, or the GBF DIME format, just simply to begin to automate the census records. The census has a particular problem in that every 10 years the Constitution requires the census to be taken. This involves counting, you know, every American and creating an individual enumeration map that covers every single district in the country. That's over 250,000 maps, and every single one of them is different. Yeah, that's a very complex automated task. This most recent census, the 2010 census, was the first time it was done entirely on GIS-based handheld recording systems. Even the census data was collected that way. Before that, those maps were printed as paper maps, 250,000 unique paper maps. So any way they could automate that was a big deal. Then we saw early systems, some being developed in a university setting, some in a production setting. The Canada Geographic Information System was a public project in Canada to do a land inventory of the whole country. You know, we got the Minnesota system, the New York system, the land use system for New York, the grid system. And eventually these became influential at Harvard University, where the Odyssey system was created, but introduced on a broad scale, though it had been used before, the topological art node or the vector data structure. We're going to spend entire lectures on the vector data structure, so a lot more about that later. This is what World Data Bank 2 looked like. The CIA put out a piece of software to display it called Computer Assisted Mapping, or CAM, and this is still in use today. I still use it every once in a while. A very useful database. Just some highlights. SAGE, which came into production in 1963, was I've argued, was kind of what kick-started a lot around computing information systems, networking, and computer graphics and mapping. Now, SAGE was the early warning system for incoming aircraft and then later missiles that would come from the former Soviet Union over the Canadian Arctic towards the cities of the United States. And it was the first instance where an enormous number of radar stations had inherently geographic data that needed to be pooled and shared. So this led to creation of all sorts of things, including sort of an early version of the internet that worked over telephone lines. The Canadian GIS, 1967, that was that's actually still in use. There's a map generated from it right there. Now, this is a SAGE console down here. This guy is actually holding a laser gun, which he could aim at the CRT, because it wasn't a terminal then, it was a cathode ray display. He could aim it at the radar screen and pick up the reflectance at any given point. So it's kind of like having an early precursor to a mouse. That's what he's got in his hand right here. And then, of course, 1982, along comes the IBM PC. I'd already had an Apple for 2 years before that. But that came along and revolutionized everything. Okay, so the PC and the workstation had a major impact on GIS because it made things feasible. Things that, you know, would take an hour to load your data, now I could do it in a minute. That makes things feasible. The 80s came along, we saw all sorts of new software that could exploit the hardware. We began to see important developments like device independence. So the very, when we buy a PC today and we buy a printer, we expect the printer to be able to plug into the PC, and there's this brief interlude while a couple of wizards run, and then the printer clicks on and starts printing for me. When I started in this business, I had to sit down and write 1,000 lines of device driver code so that particular printer would work with this particular operating system. Okay, I had to solder the RS-232 connectors myself as well. Okay, user interface developments we take for granted today, things like the Windows icons, menus, and pointers type interface, the mouse, all these things had to be invented and come about. They all basically came during the 80s and the early 90s. And then starting in the 80s, the software began to get very much better very fast. So we began to get special purpose workstations for GIS like this Intergraph workstation here. Okay, where do we get information about GIS? Well, some of the following. These are covered in a little bit more detail at the end of the first chapter of the textbook. We've got specialist journals, we have magazines, we have e-magazines, we have magazines that only circulate on the internet, some of them free that you can subscribe to and get by email. We have daily blogs these days and all sorts of things. There's even a GIS specialty group now on the on some of the social networking sites. There are, again, when I started, I wrote my first book largely because there wasn't a book to teach from. But now there are hundreds of books available, so you can choose from any one of many of them. There are all sorts of professional societies, at least 5 or 6 that deal with GIS. And while you're a student, you can often join these for very little money, sometimes even free, and get benefits of them. And then, of course, there's the web and specialist conferences. Recently, we've begun to see things like the Handbook of Geographic Information Science, or the Encyclopedia, or the Dictionary of Geographic Information Science. It seemed like there was that little period about 3 years ago where everybody in academia was writing, an entry on something for one of these books, and those have all now appeared, and so they make good reference sources. On the GIS, we've got web homepages, network conference groups, professional organizations, user groups, sufficient that you can pretty much post a question about anything that you're stuck on or anything that you're thinking about and get a response to it pretty easily. Originally, GIS was only offered in geography departments, colleges and universities, now offered everywhere from engineering to archaeology, as I said. And there are tons and tons of commercial and shareware sites. So we have something like Quantum GIS, for example, an open source GIS where we can simply download and install the software with its online manual that can pretty much answer any question we want. We have an online discussion forum where you can post questions and so on and so forth. There are conferences, and one of them, or several of them, get bigger and bigger, so it's become a sort of a showcase. You can go and see what's going on, see what's new, what new features of the software is going to be available next year. This is the ESRI user conference a couple of years ago in San Diego, and it seems like every year it gets bigger and bigger, thousands of people at these meetings. Lots of journals. I would argue that these are the biggies. The International Journal of Geographical Information Systems, the Geographical rather than Geographic because it's British, or has British, had, originally had a British editor, the editor is now Australian. This is probably the flagship journal. And this journal has gone now to 12 issues a year. It's the bumper issues to get out as many papers as they're able to print. Another journal, Cartography and Geographic Information Science, also changed its name. It used to be Cartography and Geographic Information Systems. Geographical Systems, Transactions in GIS, and the list goes on and on. A former journal, it used to be a print journal, GeoWorld, has mutated and become geoplace.com, a website that has an enormous amount of published information, sort of journalists writing about GIS that are included there. And the applications chapters, what I've drawn from there. These are some of the key professional organizations. You definitely want to check out these websites, and you might consider joining some of these, because as I said, you get your last big break with these organizations when you're still a student. You pay $20 instead of the $220 that I have to pay. So JITA is the Geospatial Information Technology Association, the Association of American Geographers, the American Congress on Surveying and Mapping, American Society for Photogrammetry and Remote Sensing offer things like certification in GIS, if you want to take an exam that proves you're a GIS expert. NASIS is a cartographic group. ERISA is an extremely useful group and a website. They include things that you wouldn't find elsewhere. For example, they did a large project to develop a code of ethics for professionalism around GIS, which is still, I think, in a, sort of an exemplar of what's out there. And now the computer scientists are getting into GIS as well, and we've got two major groups, one within the Association for Computer Machinery, ACM, and one within SIGGRAPH, the graphics group, both of which have now become major conferences, usually held in San Jose. Lots of commercial websites. It seems like everybody that's anybody now serves out some kind of map that you can click on and do things with. GIS.com is one that ESRI has put together. Geoplace.com is one that I mentioned here because it includes job information. It allows you to check your resume in, and it circulates among managers in GIS and those sorts of things. Here's an old favorite of mine, something called GISL. Back in the old Usenet days, somebody started up a discussion forum in GIS, and over 20 or 30 years, pretty much every question you could possibly imagine around GIS got posted on that forum and answered. So some of the classics out of that are really, from my mind, the best textbook you can imagine in GIS. That's now been archived and is served up by the USGS at geoint.com under GISL. They can read the archives. And the list goes on and on and on. I mean, some of the biggies, we have this thing called the National Spatial Data Infrastructure. I'm going to be talking about this in class a little bit more. Geospatial One Stop, which is a federal project under the Bush administration to bring all the geographic clearinghouses, all the federal agencies' spatial information together, make it accessible through one portal. Data.gov is a single clearinghouse for information for the government. And there have been many, many since the recovery started, and so on. Recovery.gov is another good example. If you want to subscribe to even a daily news service or a news feed, these are some of the places you could go. GeoPlace, GIS Cafe is a good starting point because it's a little more low-key. GIS.com is run by ESRI, but it's more generic. and some of them are academic, but the list goes on and on and on and on. Okay? Oh, let me not forget the last one here. GISCareers.com is one of these places where you can post your resume, and they'll alert you if there's a job that meets your needs. They post every job available worldwide, if you choose, on here. It gives you the salary and where the job is and what it is. So all the contact information is right there. Get a lot of interest about careers these days, especially among seniors. Okay, ran over by a minute. My apologies. I'll see you all. When will I see you all? Next Monday.